Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And tonight we're diving into Srinath Raghavan's India's War. I've looked at this book quite a few times. It's an excellent read, really, really authoritative account of theatres of war, which don't get completely overlooked, but they certainly don't get the focus that they're really due. And we're looking at tonight the composition of the Indian Army, particularly the manner in which Indian Army officers came to be given their commissions for the first time. It was only during the Second World War that Indian soldiers were given officers' commissions. So let's dive right in. Srinath Raghavan writes, "The expansion of the Indian Army resulted in far-reaching changes to the officer corps. Until the First World War, Indians were not allowed to hold the King's Commission. The best they could hope for was a Viceroy's Commission, granted only to senior soldiers who had risen from the ranks. From 1917, however, 10 places at the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst were reserved every year for Indians. These King's Commissioned Indian Officers, KCIOs, were carefully selected. Most of them hailed from the martial classes that had fought in the war. Following the political reforms of 1919, Indians in the new Central Legislative Assembly, the CLA, began to take a keen interest in the Indianisation of the army. In response to the Esher Committee report of 1921, a set of resolutions was tabled by P.S. Sivaswamy Iyer, a leading liberal from Madras. These included demands for the setting aside 25% of the places at Sandhurst for Indian cadets and for the provision of preparatory training in India. The Commander-in-Chief of India, as well as the Indian Office, rebuffed the resolutions, arguing that their provisions would dilute the efficacy of the Indian Army and that no British officer would deign to serve under an Indian. Even a plan drawn up by the Commander-in-Chief in 1923, proposing complete Indianisation in 42 years, was swatted aside in London. The summary rejection of even so conservative a plan riled the Indians. Speaking at the next budget session of the CLA, Jinnah, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, noted that the Indian Army had 2,078 British officers. At the going rate, he asked, how many centuries will it take to Indianise the army? Concerned about a nationalist backlash, the Viceroy, Lord Reading, protested to London. This resulted in a plan to Indianise 8 units, 6 infantry battalions and 2 cavalry regiments. Thenceforth, the KCIOs would be posted only to these segregated units. So there's a number of really interesting things happening there. It is sort of, perhaps to modern ears, quite astonishing the extent to which the British Army, the British Civil Service, and the organisers of military training, the Staff College at Sandhurst, were able really to wear their racism on their sleeve, and that there was nothing really particularly controversial at the time about saying that a white officer would never agree to serve under an Indian. And there was an enormous amount of unspoken anxieties about the idea of Indian soldiers fighting, or Indian soldiers being made officers on a regular basis, and thus the, as the term goes, the Indianisation of the army. You have to remember that the Indian Army, along with the Royal Navy, is one of Britain's, in both World Wars, Britain's superpowers. It is a military force far greater in size than anything Britain can raise domestically. And the Indian Army was the means by which Britain held on to its Southeast Asian Empire. The Indian Army is useful during the Second World War for fighting, not just in Italy and North Africa, but of course in Malaya, in Hong Kong, in Singapore. The loss and the reconquest of all these areas involve Indian soldiers. So doing anything to jeopardise the control over the Indian Army is something that most British military planners won't countenance at all. Then again, you have British politicians, British, the Viceroy in India, who is able to take the temperature of local sentiments and say, you really need to concede on this because this is not like the old days. There are rising emotions here, rising angers, which cannot be so easily contained. Srinivasaraghavan writes, "The Indians saw the establishment of a military college in India, along the lines of Sandhurst, as the fastest way to Indianise the officer corps." By the way, I apologise, international listeners who aren't familiar with Great Britain and its military institutions, Sandhurst is the officer training college in Great Britain. The equivalent in America would, for example, be West Point. Yes, the Indians saw the establishment of a military college in India along the lines of Sandhurst as the fastest way to Indianise the officer corps. After several resolutions were tabled in the CLA, the government constituted the Indian Sandhurst Committee under the Chief of the General Staff. The Indian component of the committee included Jinnah and Motilal Nehru, who was the father of Jawaharlal Nehru. The committee proposed the large-scale increase in Indianisation, including the immediate doubling of places for Indians at Sandhurst, the setting up of an Indian academy by 1933, with an intake of 300 cadets for a three-year course, the abolition of the eight-unit scheme in favour of an unrestricted induction of Indian officers. The government was taken aback. After being placed on ice for over a year, the report was rejected on the grounds that it had exceeded its remit, but realising the need to mollify Indians, the government held out major concessions, such as increasing the number of places for Indians at Sandhurst from 10 to 25. The nationalists were left cold. Motilal Nehru asserted that the time that the term Indianisation was a misnomer. "The army is ours. We have to officer our own army. There is no question of Indianising there. What we want is to get rid of the Europeanisation of the army." The constitutional report prepared for the Congress under his leadership in 1928 also called for accelerated Indianisation. In Harper and Bailey's two books, Forgotten Wars and Forgotten Armies, one of the points that they make is that the calibre of officer in India, the white British officer, was particularly low. Part of the reason for this is the real talent had been killed in large numbers during the First World War. And also India was seen in many ways as something of a backwater in a British military career. It was where officers and also civil servants went in order to kind of manage hill stations in India, normally with large amounts of alcohol to make the afternoons drift away. And so the calibre of British Indian officers was highly questionable, and also their abilities to play the kind of intricate political games that were necessary diplomatically in order to make sure that British officers in general in India weren't even more unpopular than often they were. By 1930, writes Srinath Raghavan, 77 KCIOs had been commissioned in the army. So, in April 1931, the Viceroy announced the extension of Indianisation from 8 units to a full combat division of 15 units. An Indian Military College committee, chaired by the Commander-in-Chief, submitted its report later that summer. The committee recommended the establishment of an Indian Military College with an annual intake of 60 cadets for a 3-year programme. And there's also a kind of a subtle, and well, not too subtle, shift in emphasis. As these officers were given their commissions, they would not be called King's Indian Commissioned Officers, but just simply Indian Commissioned Officers, ICOs. The Royal Indian Military Academy was opened in Dehradun in October 1932, but it had an annual intake of only 40 cadets. Less than half of these would be selected by open competition. The remainder were reserved for VCOs and the princely state's troops. There are some interesting stats to read about the increase in British officers and in Indian officers. So, for example, in October 1939, a few weeks after the outbreak of the Second World War, there were 396 Indian officers. In January 1940, there are 415, and then suddenly it starts to pick up. Within a year, in the 1st of January 1941, that's gone up to 596. The following year, the 1st of January 1942, it shot up to 1,667. The following year after that, it's 3,676. On the 1st of January 1944, it's 6,566. The 1st of January 1945, it's 7,546. And a full 5 years after the start, or 6 years after the start of the Second World War, on the 1st of September 1945, it's 8,340. So it's an astonishing increase in the amount of Indian officers serving. At that point, the ability of Britain to hold on to India is highly in doubt. The British hadn't really come to terms with that fact, and many believed that it was still possible to retain India all the way up to mid-1946.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
The decision by the British government to try to put on trial men returning from the Indian National Army, who had fought alongside the Japanese, led by Subhas Chandra Bose, to put them on trial for treason, was a real error. Mainly because there was not a court in the land, not a jury that would convict them, and there was mass civil unrest. So much so that the British really shown that their ability to carry on ruling India was almost nil. Whilst there were some British, some soldiers of the Army of India. The British-led Imperial Army of India, who had deep-seated bitter hatreds towards the INA soldiers, for the most part, most Indians thought this was preposterous, and to let them come home. They thought at best they had been patriotic but misguided. Anyway, returning back to the 1930s, whilst the wartime explosion in officer commissions in the Indian Army happened rapidly after 1939, throughout the 1930s, despite the deteriorating world situation, Indianisation proceeded at a very slow pace. Srinath Raghavan writes, "As war clouds gathered, the CLA passed a resolution in September 1938, calling for a committee to recommend ways of increasing Indianisation. The government responded by appointing one led by the chief of the general staff, Alkin Lek, to examine the issue." That's real kind of kick it into the long grass sort of rhetoric. We'll appoint someone to examine things and scratch their chin and think that something must be done, but we're not going to do anything. After interviewing several KCIOs and ICOs, Alkin Lek was inclined towards the Indians' viewpoint, but before he could set down his recommendations, war broke out in Europe. The Commander-in-Chief, General Robert Cassels, was prominent amongst the Conservatives, however. In March 1940, a study commissioned by him to assess the requirements of the expanding army recommended that Indian officers should not be sent to units officered solely by the British. This would have an undesirable impact, and he quotes, "not only on the future efficiency of such units, but might be likely to prejudice the future requirement of British officers." So there is some classic jobs for the boys' staff to prejudice the future requirement of British officers. The roles that needed to be filled. Of course, one doesn't want to have large numbers of Indian officers filling jobs that British officers can be exported from Britain in order to fulfil. There's almost a suggestion that British officers don't want to have to compete for jobs in India. And this goes back to the point previously about the calibre of British officers going out to India. It was seen as a place you go if you can't get a job in a Guards regiment, or if you can't get a posting somewhere more attractive. You go to India because that's a kind of a place to hide, or a place for kind of careers that aren't really star-studded particularly to limp on. Clearly old assumptions died hard, nor did the study recommend the Indianisation of more units. It merely suggested that Indians now being given emergency commissions could be absorbed in garrison and administrative units. Cassells produced a plan that he hoped would mitigate the challenge posed by the growing number of Indian officers. His solution was to fix a high ratio of British to Indian officers in the army and to plan accordingly for recruitment. Any further acceleration of Indianisation, he warned the Viceroy, would inevitably result in ruining the Indian army as an instrument of war. So, if there's a high ratio of Indian to British officers, then every additional Indian officer means the recruitment of an equivalent number of British officers. And there's a kind of an unspoken racism there that, you know, you for whatever you do, you can't hand the Indian army over to Indians to actually run it, and it would ruin it as an instrument of war. The upshot of this was that the average number of officers in units had dropped to desperately low levels by 1941. Only after Cassell's departure from office and the appointment of Auchinleck as Commander-in-Chief did the army adopt a rational policy towards Indian officers. From January 1942, there was a marked upturn in the number of Indian officers right through to the end of the war. During the same period, the ratio of British to Indian officers fell sharply. So there is Claude Auchinleck, who led Indian soldiers and British soldiers, Allied soldiers in general, across North Africa against the Germans and the Italians to great effect, was generally very well thought of by Indian and British soldiers, and was given an awful lot of credit for his successes there. But in part, part of Auchinleck's talent was putting his trust in the Indian officers under his command. There was an air of informality about officer recruitment, and the emphasis seems to have been on getting the right sort of chap. Srinath Raghavan writes, "The recruitment of officers was a two-stage process. Initially, the volunteers were screened by their local provincial selection board. Those who got past this were then interviewed by the central selection board of the general headquarters. Initially, the army used rather informal techniques for officer recruitment. K.B. Krishna Rao, future chief of the Indian Army, was among the youngsters who made it to the second stage. There he was quizzed on general questions about the war and at greater length about his passion for cricket, how a leg break was bowled, what a late cut was, what position was known as a gully, and so on. Satisfied with his replies, the chairman of the board remarked, 'Well, Mr. Rao, I hope you will get to play plenty of cricket in the army.' A successful Jewish volunteer, JFR Jacob, was asked in his interview in mid-1941, 'Do you shoot games?' Jacob replied, 'No, sir, I don't shoot games, I shoot goals.' There were peals of laughter around the table and no further questions." Once again, this points to what Harper and Bailey were suggesting, a degree of laxness, of amateurism in the British-led Army of India and the Raj in general, which makes the kind of explains in some ways the successes of the Japanese in other parts of Asia, and the idea that in places such as Malaya and Singapore were equally seen as backwaters where careers could go to fester, and it also has a much deeper effect. At the end of the Second World War, there were people from Burma, Malaya, Singapore, and India Indians who had been a diaspora all over this area, and also Malays and Chinese and Burmese, who looked at the British and thought, what do we keep you around for? The part of the reason for a degree of consent to imperial rule in Asia was the idea that, at the very least, there is a kind of an effective military power there who, if we're attacked by the Japanese, or if there's a kind of intercommunal violence, keeps us safe. The staggering betrayal of non-white imperial subjects, particularly in Burma, where they were forced to walk back to India and told that ships leaving from Rangoon were white for whites only. And added to this, the catalogue of disasters which showed the British reputation for fighting, particularly in Asia, up until 1942, perhaps even 1943, was greatly overstated. These shake the kind of the very logic, the very rationale for empire, and it leaves doubt in the minds of many, many imperial subjects that empire has any value whatsoever. You know, you throw into this the Bengal famine and the violence of the Quit India campaign and all this kind of stuff. There's obviously huge, many, many other reasons why, after World War II, an independence movement is ultimately successful. But one reason is the fact that the British Army in India, before 1942, was really full of the kinds of officers who were not able to inspire a great deal of confidence. And you look at other parts of the British Empire at the same time, people like Percival in Singapore, it's hardly surprising. So the Indianisation of the army shows a very important transition, which has implications not just for World War II, but also for independence afterwards. Anyway, thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Do check us out on YouTube, and swing by the Explaining History Facebook group. Explaining History podcast Facebook group. And also check us out at www.explaininghistory.org. There's new content in terms of blogging going up there all the time, and a link through to our Patreon, where we gratefully receive all donations. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.